Okay. Well, hello everyone. I'm Anna. I just came back from Boston, where I was doing an internship with Quera Computing this term. It's a quantum computing company that builds neutral atom quantum processors. And I was there for 4 months and just had my final presentation last week. So that's basically what this talk is based off of. It was originally quite a bit longer. I cut it down a little. So we'll just see how we are on time. Ask as many questions as you want, because it's very open-ended. There are lots of plots at the end. So depending on how many questions people have during the talk, we'll look at more or less of those plots. Just so you know. That being said, just a few introductory words on Quera. As I said, they build neutral atom quantum computers. It was, in particular, a super exciting time to join the company because they literally launched their first computer a month after I joined. Myself, however, I was not in the hardware team. I didn't switch to the experimental side. I was part of the scientific software team. And the main task of that team is to work on Blockade. Blockade is their open source platform where, on the one hand, you can just learn about neutral atoms, so it has loads of tutorials. And the tutorial I got to write will also be up there soon. It's not ready yet, so I can't show it to you today. But yeah, it has loads of tutorials, and it's also the platform to simulate the quantum computer. As you can imagine, currently it's very important to know whether the machine is working. So you don't want to just rely on running a task on the quantum processor. You also want to compare it against classical simulation methods. And that is pretty much what my project was about. It was integrating some quantum Monte Carlo into this open source platform. And before I jump into that project, I just wanted to give a little acknowledgement to also our group here, The Pickle with Roger Melko. This is us in Roger's backyard when Roger wasn't at home. So that says a lot about how much he trusts us. And this guy right here, I want to point out that is E-Jazz. You won't see him on, or you won't see a picture of him very often. He tries to stay offline. So this is your chance to see E-Jazz. Very important, he published this paper last year, and this was the basis for my project. So credits to him and his work. Oh, that's not, where did the next slide go? Okay, no, this is fine too. First question, why do we want quantum Monte Carlo? I already gave a little bit of motivation, but let's talk about it in a bit more detail. On the one hand, you can answer the question from a very practical perspective. So, you know, you have some probability distribution, like us in quantum mechanics, calculating expectation values of observables. However, as we're all familiar, that problem scales exponentially with the system size, so we can't solve the problem exactly. Instead, this is where Monte Carlo comes in, we invoke randomness to sample from that distribution and to approximate the solution numerically. For those of you who are a bit more familiar with different numerical techniques, I put up a few comparisons. So what about exact methods such as exact diagonalization? They can go up to roughly tens of qubits, let's say, whereas QMC can go up to hundreds of qubits, just for to put it into context. What about DMRG? DMRG, again, just for those who know, it can go up to very large system sizes as well, but it is more restricted to one-dimensional systems. Two-dimensional you can do through like a snaking algorithm, but that introduces long-range interactions that that method is not constructed for. So in this comparison, QMC has, let's say, a 2D advantage. And finally, what about QMC versus Aquila, which is that quantum computer I mentioned in the beginning, or the quantum simulator that got launched? Well, that machine has 256 atoms, so 256 qubits. We can simulate that with the quantum Monte Carlo, no system size advantage, but it might be easier to compute certain types of observables with it. And just to finish off this, this motivation, he had the practical perspective, but I also like to mention this historical perspective. I really liked learning about that during the internship, because it turns out that Monte Carlo was pretty much really the birth of computational physics. And at this point, just to throw a quick question at the audience, when do you think the first Monte Carlo simulation was run? What do you guess?
Early
2000s. Early 2000s? Okay, okay. Any other guesses? Okay, I'll ask you as well, on what do you think it was run? Well, it was run on the following, the ENIAC in 1948. And I think this is just so cool to know because it really highlights how the history of computational physics is really linked with the birth of computers themselves. And final question, what do you think was the subject matter of that simulation? It's also very much linked to that period. It's also not such a, well, you can have different opinions on it. It was the hydrogen bomb. Well, more precisely, a neutron diffusion process. How do these neutrons diffuse in the material it's used? It was after the war. People like Fermi, Stanislav Ulam, John von Neumann, they were all involved in these things. So, yeah, I find Monte Carlo super important for the birth of computational physics. It's just another motivation to have why you should be interested or could be interested in this method. Okay, now let's actually get started. Just to bring everyone a bit on the same page with regard to Monte Carlo basics, who has seen this GIF before? Okay, Lauren, great. Maybe I'll just say very brief, a few words on it. The problem is you want to calculate pi. How do you do that? You take a circle, because through an integral, right, you want some distribution, it's related to pi. You put it in a square or a quarter of it, and you start to randomly throw darts or dots at that square. And while you're doing that, you count how many dots land inside, how many dots land outside the circle. You form the ratio of those two numbers. You times by the area of the square, which you can compute. And that, in the limit of large n, will approximate the area of the circle. In case you're wondering, where did the randomness come in? Yes, that was because we were randomly, independently throwing dots at that circle. This is the most prototypical example of how you can compute something with Monte Carlo. And I just want to emphasize one thing about this, kind of a theme. Namely, I find it useful to think about Monte Carlo as always consisting of two things. First component, what is my sample space? Very easy here. It's literally the square. You know, I'm throwing darts at it. The other component, how do I navigate that sample space, that configuration space? And in this case, that's literally just randomly sampling from it. That becomes a little different if we zoom in onto a more specific class of Monte Carlo methods, namely Markov chain Monte Carlo. The difference here is that you don't independently generate a bunch of samples, but you build a chain of them. And that chain is a Markov chain, comes up in many contexts, let's say economics. You have a set of states, those are the circles here, and you transition between those states with a certain probability. And the probability to transition into the next state in that chain only depends on the state you are currently in. That's the so-called Markov property. And as you can imagine, you know, the samples here aren't independent anymore, and that will be important later on when we actually run a Monte Carlo simulation. you need to think about your error analysis, autocorrelation, stuff like this. And just to briefly return to the theme, again, we have some sample space, could be anything in quantum mechanics, your configuration space, but we are not independently randomly sampling from it. We're using important sampling. For example, Metropolis-Hastings is the most typical algorithm. Who's heard of Metropolis-Hastings, just so I have an idea? Okay, a lot of people, that's great. And yeah, it's just particularly useful when you have a huge state space. You don't want to waste your computational resources on computing something in unimportant areas of that space. You want to quickly get to the most important parts of it. Okay, so now, very quick, why quantum Monte Carlo? Or, no, not why, we already answered that. Quantum Monte Carlo, what is it? It's just Monte Carlo applied to a quantum problem. There's nothing more quantum to it. And it is an umbrella term. It's not one method. It comprises path integral, Monte Carlo, diffusion, quantum Monte Carlo, Green's function, Monte Carlo, variational. You will hear many words. And the specific method we will focus on is the so-called SSE, quantum Monte Carlo. It stands for stochastic series expansion. And we'll see why. Okay, I think we're ready to run the demo. So we will import the package I've been working on for the past few months. Also, just don't focus too much on like this execution cell right here. We did release the package a few days ago, but we didn't know it takes 3 days until it actually becomes usable. So yeah, just don't look too closely there and you'll get a live demo experience. For completeness, we need to import a few other packages as well. As you can see, this platform that I mentioned has many sub libraries where you can implement loads of nice lattices. Block and expressions will be what we'll use to just store the Hamiltonian. And yeah, of course, for Monte Carlo, we need some pseudo-random number generator, and we want to make some plots. Now, this is something, if you run anything in Blockade, any simulation, you will start off with something that looks like this. For this example, I thought we'd just do a 9-atom chain. And for that, you use this generate sites method. It just gives out an array of the site positions, specifying some lattice geometry. This could be square, it could be Kagome, but for now, we're just sticking with a very simple chain lattice. And this is also very important. And we'll keep coming back to that. With the neutral atoms in this quantum computer, they are governed by the so-called Rydberg Hamiltonian. And the phases that this Hamiltonian gives rise to are not just dependent on the Hamiltonian, but also very much on the geometry specified by the lattice. So if you have a small lattice spacing, then the interaction between the atoms will be very different to when you have a larger lattice spacing, and it will give rise to Z2, Z3, Z4 types of phases. We'll see some pictures later, but I just wanted to mention it now that that scale parameter is very important for the phases of the Hamiltonian. Also important, and I'll show you the Hamiltonian later. Let's just skim over it for now. You input something called omega, something called delta, and input that into the Hamiltonian. That's just kind of black box what we need for now. And again, it's nothing new to the package. What is new, oh, I put the Hamiltonian here. I'm so sorry, I thought it came later. Well, great. It has three terms. Let's start off with the middle one. You can basically think of this as the sigma x term. Okay, maybe if we have some chalk. Right, the quantum computer needs some qubit, which is our atom. And that atom can be either in a ground state or you can use lasers to excite it into a Rydberg state. It's a very interesting state. It's a huge atom, you can say. The electron is super far out. It's like an N equals 70 excited level of this atom. And hence, it becomes very sensitive to other atoms that are also in this state. And the omega now determines the frequency with which the atom oscillates between these two terms. So if you maybe have a look at that blockade page, you will see a lot of pictures like this. Those are the so-called Rabi oscillations. And that's the superposition that is key to performing quantum computing with these neutral atoms. And yeah, it's basically the sigma X term. The phi is maybe not so important for now. It doesn't feature in our use case, so let's not talk about it. This detuning parameter, I think, is best thought of as like a chemical potential. It's basically an offset of the lasers from this excited level. So depending on whether that's positive or negative, you will favor or unfavor this excitation. So you will want more or less of the atoms to be in the ground or the excited state. And finally, this is the very important term that I was alluding to earlier when I mentioned the scale parameter, because yeah, it's simply an excitation cost between these two atoms. And if they're very close, then you will only excite one atom. Okay, and that's kind of how entanglement comes into the picture of the quantum computer. If you're close, then you will have only a 0-1 or a 1-0, but not a 1-1. And if they're far away, then you have no such effect. And I guess you can picture why the lattice spacing is so important. You know, there's one scale in this called the Rydberg blockade radius, and there's another scale, this A, of the lattice geometry, and the ratio of those two scales, we'll have a look at a phase diagram later too, where you'll see this ratio of RB to A, so keep that in mind. Depending on those two ratios, you will get different phases from this Hamiltonian. So I just wanted to touch on that since, you know, people at the company last week were familiar with this, but I guess people here probably aren't. But now comes the new part. This is the the interface method for the QMC library. What does it do? It kind of takes one H and gives you another H, so that's not very helpful. Hence, I thought I'd put up the actual object that gets created by this function. It's something called a Rydberg sampler. It stores some of the parameters that we saw before, this Rabi drive, the detuning, the geometry, something called an energy shift that we won't focus on right now. It stores an interaction matrix. Also not too exciting. What is important is this object right here, the operator sampler. And to understand that, I now want to give you some of the details of how the SSE algorithm actually works. And for that, we just need to do a few lines of algebra, starting off from the finite temperature partition function. Very simple, it's the trace of an exponential. And you can guess, right? SSE stands for stochastic series expansion. So in contrast to a path integral method or so, the first thing we do now is just write out the series expansion of that exponential. I also, for completeness, just wrote out the trace. Then we insert a couple of identities in the computational basis. And now comes a very important step. And before I show you, let me just put up one thing that is key for that, namely that big Hamiltonian that we had before. We will split up into a sum. The minus is a technical detail of local Hamiltonian terms. And they'll, in our formalism, have two labels, first T, that is the type, whether it's an off-diagonal or a diagonal term, and A, which is the lattice unit, we say. So, like, which atom is it acting on, but also is it a one-atom or a two-atom term? And through the introduction of this sum, we now get something that really determines the style of the SSE algorithm, namely a very combinatorial thing. What I mean by that is we switch the order of this sum and this product, and that gives rise to this thing Sn. That's what we call the operator sequence. Very simple. From each of those n copies of the full Hamiltonian, we choose one local term, and that will be an operator sequence. Very simple. Is that idea roughly clear, I hope? Okay. I see some head nodding. And it's always nice to have a picture. So what could an operator sequence like that look like? Well, it's something like this. And that's very important to understand, so I just want to spend a few moments on it. What's the simplest thing to understand? Perhaps the vertical dimension. In this case, we're looking at a four-atom example. The four circles are each one atom. A filled circle, let's say ground state. White circle, excited state. What's the next thing we could understand? Let's say the boxes. The boxes are just those Hamiltonian terms. If the box is on one horizontal line, then it's a one-atom term. If the box is between two horizontal lines, it's a two-atom term. So this is clear, I guess. This is clear. And for this one, it's just acting between the first and the third atom, not the second one. And now the final thing is, well, what is the horizontal dimension of this sample? That is the expansion order of the series expansion. Here, I still wrote out a sum from n equals 0 to infinity, but as you can imagine, in the algorithm, you know, we have to truncate that. And moreover, that is precisely one of those huge intractable sums that we don't want to do analytically, that we want to sample from. And hence, you can really picture that in this SSE configuration space, each sample arises from one expansion order. That is what we are sampling from. And I keep putting chalk somewhere. Okay, let's stick with red. Something very interesting about this distribution is that it follows a Poisson distribution. Can I just ask whether people can see this? Okay. You remember that we had something that looked roughly like this, minus beta h to the n over n factorial from that partition function. So, yeah, that's literally a Poisson distribution. So the weights, if this is kind of our expansion order, will follow this type of behavior. So this will be governed, or, you know, this expansion order will be roughly the same order of magnitude as beta times h. And this is important because that tells us that we can truncate that infinite sum at some maximal expansion order. And again, recall, this is a Markov chain method, so we're doing important sampling. We're trying to find the important parts of that configuration space, and that will be roughly in this area. There will be a lot of terms that we just don't care about. And hence, in this algorithm, we truncate the expansion order. And there are many more technical details I could go into, let's say, in reality, you know, we introduce one Hamiltonian term that doesn't even exist in the Hamiltonian, namely an identity, which is just there to pad all the other operators because, you know, this is numerics. We want, like, our array to always be the same size. There's lots of stuff going on behind the scenes like that. But the main message is just this is the first component of our algorithm. That's the configuration space. And the weight of it follows a Poisson distribution. So they will all have roughly the same horizontal dimension. And that brings us back to the first question we were asking, namely, what is that operator sampler? The operator sampler consists of the weights in this picture. And a weight is literally just bra, Hamiltonian term, ket. That's how to translate this picture into algebra. Those weights get stored in that object we created in the beginning, and we will use it to perform something similar to a Metropolis Hastings step. That's what's contained in that H object. The update rules I will probably skip for the sake of time. I'll just give one comment, namely, again, it's a Markov chain. We want to ask the question of, given one state, how do I get the next state? And in this picture, it means you will just go from left to right and ask, what is the weight of this Hamiltonian term? And compare that to some randomly proposed other weight or other Hamiltonian term you could have in this slice. And then you might remove this one and insert a different one or not. And you go to the next one, the next one, the next one, and thus generate the next sample. So, yeah, I just want to emphasize that literally this whole thing is one sample. And if you copy that picture and iterate through it once, that will be the next sample. The next sample is not just going from one to the next and changing one aspect of the picture. And there are also other updates involved. And they really form the meat of the algorithm. Those are the hundreds of lines of code that you need to ensure that these update rules are ergodic. You know, the second important second component of the algorithm is, you know, what people who do Monte Carlo really worry about, ensuring that it's ergodic, that you're properly exploring the phase space. But on the other hand, the purpose of an internship like this is also to create a very easy to use interface. So you don't see any of that when you're running the algorithm. And hence, I'm also not going to go into more detail here. Instead, let's use the last 5, 10 or so minutes to look at some plots. One final thing. We need to specify a few parameters, namely how long do we want to run the simulation for? And you'll see that is not just one phase, but we have two phases, first an equilibration phase and then the sampling phase. And during that first phase, what happens is that you basically start off from some configuration with a very low weight, probably. We need to initialize the algorithm, and we really want to reach this important part of the distribution. And what does that actually look like? Well, I hope you've started to get into like the mindset of this SSE algorithm, namely that it's all about these expansion orders. And the expansion order is, once again, the length, the horizontal length of that picture. So what happens during that equilibration phase is that just the length of that horizontal picture goes up, 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 and eventually stabilizes somewhere around this mean value. And yeah, people who deal with MC know there's no, unfortunately, fixed formula to tell you when this equilibration happens, and you need to use some heuristics. Usually you plot some observable and just watch it converge and then hope that that's your equilibration value. And as you'll see in a moment, indeed, the length of the operator is an observable. It's related to something very relevant. But we'll get there in a moment. Just side comment, this length, that is the N, but I mentioned these algorithmic details about the M, right? The padding, wanting the array to be a constant length, right? So you want some extra space in there for those identity operators, but I guess that's not so important for us today. So let's just finish off the initialization. As we saw, it's a finite temperature algorithm. So we need to specify a beta that's large enough for us to approximate the ground state. These are just more initializations that we don't think to worry about right now, I think. And hence, now let's get to the plots. Again, for context, I thought I'd just put in some screenshots from typical papers that people at Quera all know, but people here might not know. This is one of those phase diagrams I mentioned. The Rydberg-Hamiltonian particularly gives rise to a lot of ordered phases, which you'll see on the next slide. And what I just want to highlight about this phase diagram is precisely that ratio that I mentioned of the blockade radius to the lattice spacing. Again, the blockade radius defines at what point we transition from this entanglement, where you only have one excitation, to potentially having two excitations, and A is the lattice geometry. And then this is just the relevant ratio of two parameters in the Hamiltonian we saw. And to make things a little more visual, this is what we're hoping to achieve with our quantum Monte Carlo simulation, a checkerboard phase, or a striated phase, a star phase. There are all of these funny excitation patterns you can create by tuning those two ratios in the Hamiltonian and the geometry. And I think, yeah, this was relevant for the people at Quera, you know, understanding how to actually run the algorithm. So I won't go into too much detail now, except point out the NC step beta function. That's what you call every time to go from one sample to the next in the chain. You do that in the equilibration phase and in the sampling phase. And we want to create a density plot. So let's jump straight to that. Voila, this is a Z2 phase, kind of the equivalent of the checkerboard phase, but in 1D, because we had a chain. And again, just to maybe give some context, if we change that ratio, then we would maybe have 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 as the pattern that emerges. We can also do bigger examples because indeed what we just saw, exact methods could compute that as well. So let's say we did a 10 by 10 square lattice, which you can't compute using exact methods. And yeah, you get this wonderful checkerboard phase that people also see in the lab. I do have to say, when I showed this plot to some of the people at Quera, they said, oh, well, what's going on here? You know, this is not perfect, not a perfect checkerboard phase. So perhaps I would need to run this again with, let's say, a higher beta value, something like this, in order to properly converge to the ground state. But I think you get the picture. It produces these nice ordered phases. And if we changed the scale parameter I've been emphasizing, then you might get a different ordered phase like this. This is the striated phase. And to finish off, indeed, we can also compute other observables. And I really find this method so funny because it's full of surprises, full of formulas you wouldn't have thought gave you something useful. So remember, I emphasized the length of the operator sequence is actually an observable. Well, what is it? Very simple algebra. This is the expectation value. What can we do? Drop the first term, cross out the n, reshift, get out a beta times h. Hence, we can literally compute the energy expectation value from the length of that operator sequence. I think that's very funny. SSE really is this combinatorial thing. And indeed, if we now run the same example as before for simplicity and do some error analysis too. I mentioned, right, Monte Carlo, Markov chain Monte Carlo. You have to pay attention to the autocorrelation of the samples in the chain. And you can do that, for example, by binning. Binning just means you don't treat every sample individually. You take a bunch, you average them together, take the next bunch, average them together, and get a reduced sample set size. If you do all of that, and you run in exact ionization for comparison, then you see that the two methods agree with tiny error bars. Those error bars can also be enlarged or made smaller through varying the sample size, the number of Monte Carlo steps. It was very satisfying to see when this finally worked out. You can do the same for a order parameter. In this case, the staggered magnetization. The staggered magnetization, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's just counting plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one, and can detect something like that Z2 ordered phase. And you can see this is very typical in this field of Rydberg physics, that you do a sweep in the detuning parameter, for example, and see, okay, we go from everything being in the ground state to this Z2 ordered pattern. And the staggered magnetization is the right order parameter to see that. And to finish on an outlook, what is it going to be used for, this library? They're interested in many more phase diagrams of that Hamiltonian, in particular, this 2D Fassi-Sutherland lattice, in case you know it. They've done DMRG on this, but as I mentioned, that method has problems in 2D, so they want some quantum Monte Carlo. You can also do dynamics with it. That's actually very interesting because, as you probably know, there is a huge open question: what are quantum computers really useful for? Where do you get an advantage? And one area where you do have a promising advantage is non-equilibrium dynamics in condensed matter. But you can also do some of it with quantum Monte Carlo, so I'll be very interested to see where kind of the boundary lies between what is classically simulable and what can you only do with literally observing the quantum system. And finally, there's also stuff with machine learning where they can use QML to generate samples that they then use to do all kinds of real-world application in these generative machine learning models. And finally, what did I learn? I think it was really cool after a year at PI, just being at a company, completely different work environment, seeing the experimentalists actually getting this machine to work. It's incredibly fragile, seeing also the tasks come in, because this machine can now be accessed by anyone. If you log in online, you can send tasks to it. And just seeing that happen and how many components need to come together from the hardware to the software was very cool. Like, really 40 people working together. I did not expect to see that amount of collaboration in a short period of time. And I made many good friends, and hope I get to go back at some point. And if you're around end of January at IQC, there will be a cool Canadian graduate quantum conference, and we'll be presenting more about what else you can do with blockade there. So, thank you.